Phillips and then Jennifer Vandermeus are tied up in traffic. They'll be here any moment. They're going to talk about, and I'm going to start it off, but first I'm going to tell you, June 12th, our second Tuesday, Frank DeCastri from Foley is going to present on small business bankruptcy. So that's the second Tuesday in June, Frank DeCastri on small business issues in bankruptcy. Here comes Professor Lipson. In July, we're looking for a tax issue, I think. Maybe that LLC, individual LLC members. And
possibly in August and July. Oh. Guaranteed
student loans in July. Possibly in August, a tax issue on individual members and the tax effects of their things happening to their LLC or their partnership. And then we talked about yesterday, we're out of ideas after that, but somebody had a great idea, I don't know if it was Bob or somebody, research, effective legal research. I mean, since I got out of school, of course, it's totally different, and I'm sure that's the same for others. And so we hope to put together a panel with our librarian, Barbara, and then maybe some of the law clerks, and you know, look at the different areas and how do you do effective bankruptcy research, Lexis, Westlaw, Best Case, Lowest Law, et cetera. So stay tuned for that. We're going to try to put that together. If you do have an idea for a topic, let me know or let Tom Koenig know, Tom King, et cetera. We're having some technical difficulties with our video. They can see us, but they cannot hear us. We're working on that. But our folks here in Milwaukee, Professor Lipson, Jennifer Vandermeus, not Victoria, whatever. I merged her with a friend of my son's rather than being a friend of my daughter. So I'm sorry about that. Jennifer and Professor Lipson, King versus Marshall and O'Keefe versus Aurora.
Okay, how long do we have, Judge?
So it's 9:30.
9:30, okay.
And you're talking to the mics?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear us? You guys can hear us because you're sitting in. Okay. So I'm Jonathan Lipson from the law school. This is Jennifer Vandermeus. With me, she's Judge Martin's clerk. Thanks for coming out today to talk about Stern and O'Keefe. I'm sure you've all spent a lot of time thinking about both cases already. One of the reasons we wanted to talk about them, and we've done this show already in Madison, is because the more we sort of thought about what they said and what they meant, the more we read them, the less we actually felt like we knew what they meant or said. And so it was a little like being back in law school. Like, the more you study, the less you know. And so we're trying to figure out, well, why is that? What is it about these cases that's so confusing? You know, if you've taken a look at the outline that we did, you know, according to Judge Leonard, you know, probably by this point, you know, close to 300 opinions have been published on the effect of Stern and Ortiz, and we're trying. And what I think that means is that these cases have really destabilized the way we think about what it is that bankruptcy courts can and cannot do. And so, the outline that you have, what we'll talk about today, in part, is designed to help, I guess, explain why we think these cases are so complicated, why they're so destabilizing to lawyers and judges and people who think about what bankruptcy courts are supposed to do. But we also have what we hope will be some practical advice about how to deal with what we think the cases are trying to do. Obviously, they're a moving target. You know, just last week, Judge Rakoff, I think, came down with an opinion in the REFCO fraudulent transfer litigation, so, you know, saying that he had the authority and not bankruptcy court to deal with those litigations. So there's all sorts of moving parts here, and I suspect that will continue to be the case for some time. What we'll do, I think, is Jennifer's going to kind of march us through a refresher on what happened in the two cases, Stern and Ortiz, I'll then talk about some three things that I think make the cases, two sets of three things that make the cases so difficult, a set of contradictions built into the cases and sort of very different ways of thinking about what bankruptcy courts should be doing that I think is what leads to those contradictions. And then we'll talk through some hypotheticals and a decision tree that might help us understand this. I should say at the outset that you know, one of the things that I do think is right is that even though the cases themselves, especially Stern, speak in very, very broad terms, and that breadth can be problematic, I'm not persuaded that the result in those particular cases is wrong. And so it's I think what part of what's confusing here is that these cases are, you know, it's the classic adage, you know, bad facts make for bad law. So if you look at these cases and you look at some of the cases on which they rely, Brandt and Sierra, Langenkamp, Bukulp, and so on, they're all really bizarre cases, factually speaking or procedurally speaking. And so that makes it difficult to know, well, what kinds of inferences can you draw from them generally? Well, all we have to go by is the language of the cases, and that, of course, is part of what makes them so, you know, so difficult to figure out. So, Jennifer, you want to start with Stern and Ortiz? Tell us, refresh us on what happened there.
Sure. So, bear with me as I go through these. I know that a lot of you are familiar with the facts of Stern and Ortiz, but it will help as we set up some of these issues. So, the facts of Stern. Vicki Lynn Marshall, who is better known as Anna Nicole Smith, was married to a wealthy older man named J. Howard Marshall. And during their marriage, Marshall gave her lots of gifts, but he did not include her in his will. Now, Marshall had a son named Pierce, and Pierce and Vicki didn't get along very well. In fact, even before Marshall died, Vicki filed a claim in Texas probate court saying that Pierce was fraudulently inducing his father to keep her out of his will. So Marshall dies, and then Vicki, having been left with no interest in the will, filed bankruptcy in California. And then Pierce filed a claim in her bankruptcy case for non-dischargeability, alleging that she defamed him through her statements that he was trying to fraudulently gain control of his father's wealth. He also filed a proof of claim for damages associated with the defamation. Vicki filed a counterclaim to that suit, alleging tortious interference with the gift that she expected from Marshall. The bankruptcy court granted summary judgment in favor of Vicki on the defamation claim, and then almost a year later ruled on Vicki's tortious interference with gift claim. The court ruled in her favor, and she was awarded hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. In later bankruptcy proceedings, Pierce argued that the bankruptcy court did not have authority to enter that judgment because Vicki's counterclaim was not a core proceeding. But the bankruptcy court said, no, this is a core proceeding clearly under 157B2C, which is counterclaims by the estate against persons filing claims against the estate. The matter went to the district court, and the district court said, actually, this counterclaim is not core. But in the meantime, the Texas probate court held a jury trial in which, on an issue virtually identical to Vicki's tortious interference with gift claim, the jury entered a verdict in favor of Pierce. So we have a judgment in bankruptcy court in favor of Vicki, a judgment in Texas probate court in favor of Pierce, and all of a sudden it became a very big deal whether the bankruptcy court judgment was a final judgment. It would determine who won. The district court said this was not a core proceeding, and so the bankruptcy court judgment was not final, but it did not give the Texas probate court judgment preclusive effect. Instead, it entered its own judgment in favor of Vicki, and she won in the district court. So then the matter went up to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit reversed and remanded on what is known as probate exception, not really relevant for our discussion today. Went up to the Supreme Court once. They kicked it back to the Ninth Circuit to address the issue of whether her counterclaim was core. And the Ninth Circuit said, nope, this is not a core proceeding. Therefore, the district court erred in not giving the Texas probate court judgment preclusive effect. So when all was said and done, Pierce won in the lower courts.
And for those of you who are visually inclined, we've tried to put together a little timeline
here. On page 4 of the outline.
Brings out all the Bleak House, you know, details here.
So the Supreme Court granted certiorari and held that while the bankruptcy court had statutory authority under 157B2C to enter the final judgment as a court proceeding, it did not have constitutional authority to do so. The court said that bankruptcy judges lack authority under Article 3 of the Constitution to enter final judgments on claims that constitute the stuff of traditional actions at common law tried by the courts of Westminster in 1789. We'll talk about that language a little bit later. Some of the reasons underpinning the court's decision kind of came from various lines of law. One was that Vicki's counterclaim did not qualify for the public rights exception. Another was that the process for adjudicating Pierce's proof of claim would not necessarily resolve Vicki's counterclaim, even if there was some factual overlap in the claims. Really, what concerned the Supreme Court was whether the action stemmed from the bankruptcy itself or would necessarily be resolved in the claims allowance process. And because Pierce's claim had been disallowed almost a year before the court considered Vicki's counterclaim, nothing that the court did with her counterclaim was going to have any effect on that proof of claim. And then finally, the court looked at consent a little bit. Justice Roberts said that Pierce did not truly consent to the resolution of Vicki's counterclaim because essentially he had nowhere else to go if he wanted to collect from her estate. In contrast, the Supreme Court said that by course of conduct, Pierce did consent to the bankruptcy court adjudication of his own claim for defamation. The court noted that Pierce had advised the bankruptcy court that the parties agreed that the amount of his contingent proof of claim would be decided in the adversary proceeding. And that looked a lot like consent to Chief Justice Roberts. So when Pierce made the argument that the bankruptcy court didn't have statutory authority under 157b-5, which essentially states that a district court is to decide personal injury cases, the Supreme Court found that he had waived that argument because he didn't bring it up below. So that's some of the background with Stern. In terms of Ortiz was up at the Seventh Circuit level when Stern was decided, but I'll back up and give you some of the context. Aurora Healthcare filed proofs of claim in about 3,200 Chapter 13 cases in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. These proofs of claim publicly disclosed the debtors' medical information, and the debtors were not too happy about that. They filed two class action lawsuits against Aurora, one in state court and one in bankruptcy court, alleging basically the same thing, that Aurora violated a state statute by disclosing their medical information. The state case was removed to the bankruptcy court, and then all parties proceeded to try to get this thing out of bankruptcy court. The two sets of debtors filed motions to remand and motions for the bankruptcy court to abstain in favor of the state court, and Aurora filed a motion to withdraw the reference to the district court. But because these matters were found to be core under 157 B2, B, and C, the allowance and disallowance of claims and counterclaims, the motions were denied, and the bankruptcy court ultimately entered summary judgment in favor of Aurora. Now, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals granted direct appeal of this case on the premise that the bankruptcy court had entered a final judgment, which gives the Court of Appeals appellate authority under 157 D2 to hear matters on direct appeal. So the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral argument in February of 2011. In June 2011, Stern was decided, and in light of that decision, the Court of Appeals ordered supplemental briefing on the issue of whether the bankruptcy court had authority to enter that judgment in Aurora's case. After considering the issues, the Court of Appeals held that, like the bankruptcy court in Stern versus Marshall, the bankruptcy judge here lacked Article III authority to enter a final judgment on the debtor's state law claims. And without a final judgment, the Court of Appeals lacked a statutory basis for appellate jurisdiction. Now, some of the reasoning underpinning this decision tracked a lot with Stern versus Marshall. The debtor's claims, like Vicki's counterclaims, involved private parties disputing interests defined by state law. They followed a lot of the language of the public rights exception, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, that these claims don't flow from a statutory scheme and they're not historically determined by executive or legislative branches, et cetera. And furthermore, like the Vicki's counterclaim, there was no reason to believe that the process of adjudicating Aurora's proofs of claim would necessarily resolve the debtor's claims here. This is just a claim to augment the bankruptcy estate. And just because there were circumstances in the proofs of claim that gave rise to the debtor's complaint, that was not enough to bypass Article 3's requirements. And then a note on consent. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals found that consent was basically not present here. Aurora had compared the debtor's opposition to its motion to withdraw the reference to cases where a party's course of conduct could be evidence of consent to adjudication by a non-Article III judge. But the Court of Appeals said, well, you can't say that the debtors consented because they actually filed motions to remand and abstain. They didn't want the bankruptcy case court to adjudicate this either. And even if we were to find that the debtors consented, you, Aurora, didn't consent. You filed a motion to withdraw the reference. So because all parties were not found to have consented, the Seventh Circuit said that this case does not present any question about a bankruptcy judge's authority to enter final judgment when the parties have consented. So we still don't know if consent would have solved the problem here. So without a statutory basis for direct appellate jurisdiction, the court dismissed the appeal and remanded it to the bankruptcy court. They said that unless and until an Article III judge enters a final judgment, we have no jurisdiction to review these matters. Now, an interesting problem that this decision created was that the Court of Appeals said that this was a core proceeding, but because of the Article III considerations, the final judgment was not a valid final judgment. But nor could these be treated as proposed findings of fact because we already said that they're core. So what to do? Well, the bankruptcy court resolved the matter pragmatically by essentially giving the opportunity for a final judgment to be entered. On remand, Judge Kelly entered proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law on the defendant's motion for summary judgment, and in the alternative, made a motion to withdraw the reference to the district court. That would essentially give the opportunity to enter a final judgment, which would resolve the problem. So that's some of the background of the cases, and now Professor Lipson is going to talk about why some of the inherent reasoning lines are problematic.
Right. If you sort of step back and you think about the cases, not only is it, I think, not all that difficult to say, well, you know, if you just limit Stern to its facts, it's really not that much different than Marathon, and it's really not that exciting, and who cares, and goodness, you know, Stern is so bizarre. I mean, not Stern, Ortiz is so bizarre, you know, it's like not likely that, you know, creditors frequently commit some kind of state law created tort or quasi tort by filing a proof of claim. So these are just weird outlier cases. But then when you actually read the rhetoric of the cases, what you find is that, you know, it sounds like they could be talking about an awful lot more than just these cases that are limited, you know, as limited by their facts. So one way to think about what's so confusing about them is that they seem to embody three contradictions. Number one, they're sort of rhetorical contradictions. Number two, there are sort of structural contradictions in how they think about what it is that the bankruptcy courts are supposed to be doing. And number three, there are these procedural contradictions that they leave us with. And, you know, we're all trained as lawyers, right? And so we don't like contradictions. We like things to be logical and straightforward and, or if not straightforward, at least, you know, sort of linear, right? So we can, you know, move from A to B to C, and we don't like it when things seem to be internally inconsistent. And so I think part of what's destabilizing about these cases is that they have these internal contradictions. And let me just describe three of them and then talk about sort of why I think we have them. And then we'll do some practical stuff. So rhetorical contradictions, that's, I think, pretty clear from the opinions themselves, right? If you just read Stern, you know, on the one hand, the Chief Justice says, look, this is not a big deal here, right? This is just about the division of labor. We're not talking about jurisdiction. We're not talking about anything really exciting here. We agree with the United States in its amicus brief that the question presented here is a narrow one, right? And so, you know, if you think, well, it's just about, you know, counterclaims to proofs of claim and whatever, then, you know, maybe it's like Marathon and it isn't that huge. But that's not all he says, right? The majority opinion goes on to have this really grand sweeping language about the creation of the republic and separation of powers, and this is really all about protecting the judiciary from the encroachment of those, you know, political hacks in Congress. And, you know, my goodness, this is why we have, you know, an Article III, right? So he says, you know, starts by saying, look, it's clear that the bankruptcy court in CERN exercised the judicial power of the United States in purporting to resolve and enter final judgment on Vicki's, you know, state common law claim. And this is a problem because when, you know, a suit is made of the stuff of the traditional causes of action at common law tried by the courts at Westminster in 1789. By the way, has anybody here ever been to Westminster? Are they still trying cases there? I mean, and what would happen to Vicki's case there now? Like, I don't know. Anyway, would her cause of action even have existed in Westminster in 1789? Tortious interference with gift? I don't know. There's a lot of odd royal stuff, maybe. And is brought within the bounds of the federal jurisdiction. The responsibility for deciding that suit rests on Article III judges and Article III courts. So, I mean, if you think about that, right, well, I don't know what Westminster was doing exactly, and it sounds like nobody here does, so I can just sort of make it up. But, I mean, I think what they were thinking was, this is the common law stuff, right? This is contract actions, this is tort actions, this is property, this is the basic stuff that, you know, constitutes common law adjudication. Well, if that's what Article III judges do to the exclusion of Article I judges, what the heck is left for bankruptcy judges, right? Most claims asserted in a bankruptcy case are going to derive from what? Contract, tort, something like that, that comes from something that Westminster would have been doing in 1789. So, goodness gracious, you know, is that really what he means? Can't be, right? Can't really be what he means, but it's what he says. So we got this contradiction. Says narrow, speaks broad. Leads to this sort of second contradiction, which is structural, right? He says, well, look, at, you know, we're basing what bankruptcy courts can do and what Article III judges are supposed to be doing on what, you know, England was doing in 1789. But the problem is that they also say that the whole basis for deciding Stern as we decided it was that we didn't like that English system, right? We rejected it when we created Article III. We said, well, look, the colonists had been subject, this is a quote from the case, the colonists had been subject to judicial abuses at the hands of the crown. The framers knew the main reason why. Because the King of Britain made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. The framers therefore undertook in Article III to protect citizens subject to the judicial power of the new federal government from a repeat of those abuses. So, I'm like, well, which is it? Is England, you know, in 1789 telling us what we can do, or did we reject England in 1789? You know, it can't be both. It's one or the other. And that's a contradiction that I think runs through a lot of federal court jurisprudence. It's not unique to bankruptcy, but it's a big problem. Now, we've gotten around this to some extent in other contexts with this idea of the private rights exception that I'm sure many of you have heard about. It's the idea that basically, well, all right, look, there are a bunch of things that, you know, Congress can do, and they can, in essence, determine how disputes about those things can be resolved. So, you know, if Congress creates a cause of action involving an administrative agency, what have you, then the administrative agency can resolve it, even if it sort of smells like an adjudication. That began with Murray's lessee, you know, way back in the 19th century, and it sort of continues to this day. But you know, the weird thing about the public rights exception is that, you know, the court talks about it in Stern and says, well, look, we recognize that the public rights exception exists, but it doesn't apply here because these are private causes of action, right? It's just a private claim that Vicki has against Pierce. And what's so strange about that to me, and it's more ironic than contradictory, is that if you think about it from a structural perspective, right, the class of claims that we should be concerned about protecting the judiciary from are actually the public ones, not the private ones. If we're concerned about Congress encroaching on other branches, we should be concerned about Article I created causes of action, congressionally created causes of action, not private causes of action, right? I mean, does it really, you know, I love, you know, sort of the quote from the case, does allowing the bankruptcy court to adjudicate Vicki's counterclaim really compromise the integrity of the system of separated powers and the role of the judiciary? Like, who cares? Like, that's not really what is going to cause the Republic to fall, right? I mean, there are some really important Article III questions out there about, you know, the executive branch and whatever, and Congress, but I'm not sure Vicki Lynn's, you know, counterclaim is one of them. And the third class, so second contradiction is sort of structural stuff, like we're talking about how important it is that we separate, you know, the judicial function and sort of insulate it from political encroachment on the one hand. On the other hand, like, we're you know, taking the whole basis for the decision from you know, a system that we said we didn't like. The third set of contradictions involves sort of the process and you know, that we're left with, which Jennifer alluded to, which is that you now have a class of core claims, at least statutorily core claims within, you know, 157, be that are core, but that cannot be adjudicated by a bankruptcy court, finally, under its Article I powers. And unfortunately, you know, it looks like 157C, which is that provision that says, well, okay, if you've got stuff that's related to the bankruptcy case, then the parties can let the bankruptcy court do the work if they consent to it, or, you know, under certain circumstances, if it's subject to, you know, final, essentially appellate review by a district court. That doesn't help here, right? Because, you know, we understand that in both Stern and Ortiz, we're not talking about stuff that's related to the bankruptcy case. We're talking about stuff that's core. So you have this gap between what it is that the statute says bankruptcy courts are supposed to do, how it divides the labor, and what it is that the Supreme Court says Article III courts must do. Yeah.
Now we're reading at
2.1.1. Yeah, I'm a little past that, but yeah.
The court actually has a quote there. The Stern court has a quote that says, essentially, Vicki's counterclaims are removed from core bankruptcy jurisdiction. Are they removed? Because in Ortiz, we just say they're core, but we don't talk about has it been removed now from core because of this constitutional problem.
Well, I mean, the statute says the counterclaims to proofs of claim are considered core. And I thought the resolution in Stern was that they were treated as core. But certainly Ortiz says no. There's absolutely no doubt that those proofs of claim were core matters.
I'm just looking back at this quote. We do not think that the removal of counterclaims from, such as Vicki's from core bankruptcy jurisdiction. So it seemed to me what Stern was saying is they're now no longer core, even though, you know, because of this constitutional problem, we're actually coming out of the core statute.
So the Supreme Court's basically rewriting the statute, right? And they, you know, they acknowledge the contradiction. In Stern does. I can't remember exactly where it is. That they're creating.
I think it's 2.3.4.
Yeah. So the court, you know, it sounds like they sort of recognize that 157C isn't going to help them out. I thought that Stern did treat Pierce's counterclaim. I'm sorry, Vicki's counterclaim rather, as being core, but certainly Stern. If it didn't, it doesn't matter because Stern, you know, Ortiz goes to the next level and says, "Well, we don't care, right? We're stuck with this you know netherworld of claims that are both core and outside of the bankruptcy court's power."
Right. And statutorily, they said that it did fall within core core jurisdiction or core authority, but there was some language toward the end of Stern that at least suggested that perhaps these core Stern claims should be treated as non-core. It wasn't explicit, but it was implied. And so courts have been kind of wondering, okay, well, is that what we're supposed to do? Are we supposed to treat these as non-core? But there is a contradiction because earlier in the opinion they said, well, they're clearly core. So there's kind of a disconnect between...
Right, between what the court's saying. I think the court says, yes, statutorily these are core, but as a constitutional matter, they cannot be treated as such. Which is part of, you know, I think why this makes people so uneasy. But one of the things that the Stern court suggests, and this wasn't an issue in Ortiz, is that consent may be a way around some of these problems. And you see that especially with respect to the treatment of Pierce's claim against Vicki. And what's interesting about all of that is that if you think about the role that consent plays in this context, I mean, we're not talking about jurisdiction, right? But we all remember from law school that you can't consent to jurisdiction, right? Either a court has it or it doesn't. And I think by inference, you can't really consent to a decision as to whether or not, you know, the Article III court has judicial authority or not. But it seems that that's what the court is implying when it relies on, you know, the Exxon case to say, well, look, Pierce, you just waived any objection you had to the bankruptcy courts adjudicating your defamation claim. You know, he was saying, well, look, it's a personal injury tort, and that's got to go to the district court. But, you know, he said it after 2 years of losing in the bankruptcy court. And so by course of conduct, he was, you know, thought to have waived that objection and thereby consented to what it was the bankruptcy court did to it. Now, what's interesting about this is that it makes me wonder if there's a distinction in Justice Roberts' mind between what I think of as inbound claims and outbound claims, right? So that the limitation on what it is that the bankruptcy court can do is really about outbound claims, claims that the estate is asserting against either creditors or third parties, such as Vicky's claim against Pierce, where perhaps consent is of no use at all, as distinct from inbound claims where, for example, Pierce is asserting his defamation claim against the estate, and maybe consent is effective there. There are proposed rule amendments at the back, or they're discussed at the back of the little outline that you've got. And I don't think it makes a distinction between the two, but I wonder if that's part of what's really going on, and I'll explain why in just a moment. So you've got these three sets of contradictions, and I think that's part of what it is that makes us queasy about all this stuff. We call this three queasy pieces because, you know, I think these contradictions derive from the fact that they're really just very different ways of thinking about the work that bankruptcy courts should be doing. And those different conceptions of bankruptcy court authority developed over time based on all sorts of historical factors that, you know, probably made sense at the time, but that may or may not make sense today. And it's not clear that, I think part of what makes these cases so troubling is that they sort of mix and match the conceptions that they use. So, the one conception of the bankruptcy court's job is what we think of as kind of an English model, right? Where, you know, you have the summary versus plenary jurisdiction. Those of you who have touched on before the 78 code will remember that distinction. And the idea was that, you know, the bankruptcy court's job was really, or the commissioner's or whoever it was, the Article I actor's job was really to just kind of take the stuff that belonged to the estate, the race, if you will, figure out who had claims against it, sort the priorities, and, you know, maybe liquidate it, sell it off, convert it to cash, and distribute it accordingly. But if you actually wanted to go and augment that estate, meaning sue somebody, well, then you had to invoke, you know, plenary jurisdiction. You had to go to a real court. You couldn't go to an Article I court anymore. You had to go, or Article I functionary, you had to go to, you know, another kind of court. And the problem with that, of course, was that it was just inefficient, right? I mean, you had, you know, bankruptcy commissioners and then bankruptcy courts and, you know, referees, a sort of whole bankruptcy apparatus developing over time that was quite capable of dealing with these things at district courts that didn't want to deal with it. And so, you know, Congress, you know, finessed this over time while simultaneously creating affirmative causes of action exclusive to bankruptcy, like the preference power. And, you know, there were 7 million cases under the 1898 Act about whether or not the bankruptcy court or the district court had, you know, plenary jurisdiction or summary jurisdiction to decide these outbound causes of action, like preference actions against third parties. And, you know, so the English model, in essence, was based on a vision of property and management of property, a little like, you know, trust and estates law. I think some people think that that's really what is driving Justice Roberts' thinking about a lot of this stuff. It's sort of behind some of the rhetoric in the majority opinion. Part of the problem, though, is that if it's really a property-based model, then it's only as good as your definition of property. And so, you know, in 1789 in Westminster, like, we sort of knew property when we saw it. It was Blackacre, right? And it wasn't that complicated. Today, what's property? Well, property is often intangible. It is often causes of action, right? Maybe they're causes of action that would have been tribal at Westminster, meaning in, you know, sort of plenary jurisdiction land. Just fundamentally different understanding of property today than we had back then. So, you know, the model, if that's our model, it's problematic because it's just sort of, it's anachronistic. A second way of thinking about bankruptcy is what I think of as kind of an administrative state model, and this is where the public rights exception comes from, and it goes back to the idea, which I think people forget, but is what makes bankruptcy so interesting and difficult, and that is that, you know, it's the only Article I power that Congress really effectuates mostly through courts, right? You know, Article I is where Congress gets all of its power, and Congress does all sorts of stuff. They, you know, impose taxes, and they regulate intellectual property, and they regulate, you know, commerce. But they do all that stuff through really large bureaucracies. And of course, there may be, you know, administrative law courts that are adjacent to those bureaucracies. But the bureaucracies are the, you know, the front lines and all this stuff. Not so for bankruptcy, right? In bankruptcy, the courts, right? The folks in this room are the front lines. We have a little, you know, the trustees program that does some stuff, you know, increasingly more, but still, just fundamentally different. And I think that's part of the confusion here. So what's problematic is that we've always had this public rights exception, but we've never been willing to extend it to the bankruptcy system. And I think that's in part because, although that public rights exception exists to facilitate congressional power to do what Congress does under Article I and kind of manage disputes in a way that doesn't offend Article III, we just don't want to extend it to the bankruptcy system. And I think that may be because we've always done bankruptcy through courts, even though it's an Article I sort of thing. And so there's just kind of this inherent, you know, problem. But, of course, you could easily say, well, look, it's really just, you know, bankruptcy is just another way of dealing with public rights. A discharge is a permanent injunction. That's a pretty powerful public thing that a public entity, a court, is giving you. So, you know, why wouldn't you just treat it that way? The court hasn't been willing to go there. And, it, you know, it's problematic in its own right because it's really quite broad. It would in effect, you know, if you really took it to eliminate Marathon, it would say that bankruptcy courts could do an enormous amount of things. A third model, which, you know, also has its own problems, is a sort of a pragmatic one, which is the one that I think we're probably most comfortable with as lawyers, which is, you know, based in rhetoric from cases like Ketchin v. Landy that, you know, talk about, well, what bankruptcy is really about is just restructuring the debtor-creditor relationship. And so, you know, all you have to do then is figure out what the word restructuring means. And we have a sort of little discussion about that at 3.3 in the outline. That we don't need to go into, but, you know, there the problem is, at one level, it's intuitive to us, right? It's clearly about, you know, kind of, you know, figuring out which claims are allowable and which claims aren't, and, you know, what property gets distributed in what order of priority and so on. But again, if you're reaching outside of the estate to go after folks to bring stuff in, to the estate, it becomes much more complicated. We've lumped lots of stuff in, we've swept lots of stuff into the bankruptcy court, under that sort of pragmatic model, but, you know, it's not hard to see that just about anything could be considered restructuring. Certainly, you know, if you had allowed Vicky's counterclaim to survive against Pierce, she would have restructured her relationship with him, her debtor-creditor relationship with him. So we can't take that language too seriously either. So we're left with sort of three reasons to be kind of queasy about what it is that's going on in these cases. They're kicking up, I think, problems that are much, much, much deeper than just, you know, can you assert a counterclaim to a proof of claim? They really go to deep structural problems embedded in the whole bankruptcy system. And, you know, Roberts has a very particular view, the majority has a very particular view about what authority bankruptcy judges should have based on a particular conception of what Article III means. And it's destabilizing because you have these other conceptions of bankruptcy power or bankruptcy authority that are just quite different and that have developed for perfectly sound historical reasons, but that may be incompatible with where at least the rhetoric of Stern is taking us. So that's all sort of why we're all nauseous about this. Let's see if we can figure out what we can do, you know, if there's any Imodium D we can take and start to feel a little bit better with some practical stuff. You want to talk about some basic takeaway points?
Some Imodium, maybe, or Tums, maybe. Right, so the question is, can we take anything away from these decisions? And despite kind of the confusion that they've created, we think that we can in terms of practice points. First of all, the Stern analysis is going to apply to more than just state law counterclaims against creditors. So don't assume that because you don't have that exact a situation in front of you that it's not going to trigger Stern. You should pay attention to all actions that could potentially trigger that analysis. And we're going to kind of go through how we might determine whether we're in Stern land or not in a little bit. Second, a counterclaim filed in response to a proof of claim is not automatically going to be deemed part of the claims allowance process. In Stern, the majority held that the bankruptcy court lacks constitutional authority to enter a final judgment on a state law counterclaim that is not necessarily resolved in the process of ruling on a creditor's proof of claim. Now, what does that mean? the majority was relying on some very old cases where the trustee had objected to a creditor's proof of claim on the grounds that there was an avoidable preference. And in order to determine whether the claim was allowed or not, they had to determine whether there was a preference. So that was part of the claims allowance process. That was the Katchen case, I believe. So that certainly would be within the bankruptcy courts. Back then it was their summary jurisdiction, but now it would just be part of the claims allowance process. But,
and core.
And core, right. But what happens when you disallow a claim long before you rule on the counterclaim? Now we have more of a problem. Interestingly, the Stern decision and the Ortiz decision didn't address whether offset would have been deemed part of a claims allowance process. That is, if you determine the amount of the counterclaim and whether that offsets the amount of the proof of claim, whether that is part of it. But it's certainly plausible that that's what they had in mind as well. The opinions just don't speak to that. But that's just something to keep in mind. It's not going to be enough that there's a factual overlap in the counterclaim. Finally, consent will likely be an important tool for resolving uncertainty about the scope of the bankruptcy court power. Courts are already recognizing that consent could be a factor in the analysis of whether the bankruptcy court may rule on something that is core but deemed constitutionally problematic. The problem is that we don't know exactly what consent looks like. We know that, according to Chief Justice Roberts, filing a proof of claim is not enough to mean that the creditor consents to a responsive counterclaim. On the other hand, a course of conduct may be enough, at least in terms of when, for the example of the, was it inbound or outbound consent?
Inbound claim, right. So we know that it seems like it might have mattered for Pierce's defamation claim that it was a claim he was asserting against the estate. And so, you know, if you believe that what, you know, Justice Roberts has in mind is this kind of English model, summary versus plenary, then, well, you know, within the summary jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court is, you know, deciding whether claims should be allowed or not. And you can consent to that or not, you know, by conduct or what have you. That's just not problematic. It's not the same thing as giving an Article I judge the power to, in effect, take property away from somebody who may not have consented to the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction at all, meaning an outbound claim.
Right. So when it's in your client's interest, make consent clear. An example is when one files an adversary complaint, you can include a statement that, you know, the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction as a core proceeding under 157 X, Y, and Z, and the parties consent to bankruptcy court adjudication of it. And then in a responsive, in an answer, the party could deem to have admitted or not. And that actually comes up in the proposed rules that are attached to the outline as what could be, you know, clear consent.
Right. One of the things that I think, I know we don't have a ton of time left, but one of the things that we thought might be helpful with, you know, some of the clarity that we do have here is to kind of think about, well, when is it that you might find yourself with a Stern kind of question? And so we tried to develop a decision tree, but, you know, you
page
notice
17.
Yeah, we're on page 16 and 17. But if you notice, our outline's still in draft because, you know, as I said, the more we think about it, the less we know. And so when we tried to come up with a tree, we were like, well, God, there's so many different things going on here, and there's so many different ways to interpret these things. Maybe it's not really a full-blown tree. Maybe it's just a shrub, right? So we have a decision shrub here, not a decision tree. But we think it's still at least a helpful starting point in trying to sort out whether you're in Stern land. And we start from the supposition that you're only dealing with outbound claims, meaning is it a claim, and this is, you know, figure 3 on page 17, you know, is it a claim of the estate, right, an affirmative claim the estate has against somebody else that arises at state law that could be adjudicated outside of bankruptcy? That sort of harkens back to this Westminster 1789 kind of idea. And if the answer is yes, you know, then maybe you are in stern land and you have to ask some other questions. If the answer is no, you know, it's not a state law claim and it wouldn't have been adjudicated outside of bankruptcy, or it's not an outbound claim at all, then, you know, and it's otherwise core, then it's going to remain with the bankruptcy court, and so you're, it's easy, you're not in stern land. But if the answer was yeah, the creditor, you know, it is an outbound claim, it was a state law claim, another court could have dealt with it, then you have to ask yourself, well, did the creditor file a proof of claim? And why is that relevant? Well, partially for consent, but mostly because of this language in Stern about is it necessary, is the outbound cause of action, resolution of the outbound cause of action necessary to resolve the proof of claim? So if the creditor didn't file a proof of claim, and the matter is not core, then it sounds like and again, it's one of these state law causes of outbound state law causes of action. It sounds like it's no longer with the bankruptcy court. It's got to go to some other court, either the district court, I guess, or a state court. Where it's slightly more complicated is, you know, if the answer is yeah, this third party did file a proof of claim, they are a creditor in effect, and it's core. The question then becomes, is the claim in question a counterclaim to the proof of claim? Such that it would be augmenting the estate if it was adjudicated, because that seems to be what was problematic for the Supreme Court and for the court in Ortiz. And you know, I think again, if the answer is no, it's not really about augmenting the estate, then maybe the inquiry ends, there. You know, so you can leave it with the bankruptcy court. If the answer is yes. Or if there's consent, then you have to go to this next stage in the analysis, which is resolution of the proof of claim, is it going to turn on resolving this outbound claim that the estate has against somebody else? And I don't know what the words necessarily resolvable mean, but that's the phrase that they use in Stern, so it seems to matter. And if the answer is no, and in Stern, it's easy to see why the answer was no. If the answer is no, then again, an Article III judge or some other judge has to deal with it. If the answer is yes, it sounds like maybe the bankruptcy court can deal with it. Now, why was it clear that the proof of claim was not necessarily resolvable by, adjudicating Vicky's claim? Well, because they'd already made a decision on Pierce's proof of claim, right, a long time earlier. So he was whatever he was owed, and the bankruptcy court had figured that out. Whereas they waited two more years to deal with Vicky's affirmative cause of action stated as a counterclaim. And so part of what's interesting and problematic about this is that, if you think about it at one level, it's like, well, isn't this just an offset? And if it's just an offset, like why, are we not undermining the whole idea of offset? And the answer, I guess, in part is that, Stern was a function of timing, right? It was just a function of what happened in what order, which is why we have that long timeline there, because it seemed to matter. But, ask yourself, well, what if the counterclaim and the proof of claim were dealt with at the same moment, right? Would Judge Bufford have had to have said, well, you know what? I'll figure out what Vicky owes you, but for us to figure out what you owe Vicky Pierce, we got to send it someplace else, right? We don't know where someplace else is, by the way, because you haven't actually sued her anywhere. So you better go hire yet another lawyer to go do that. But we don't know. We don't quite know what necessarily resolvable really means. But so that's kind of the way we, filter it down. Those are some of the things that seem to be important in these opinions. So let's talk through a couple of the hypotheticals. I know you guys got to get to your day jobs. Why don't we start with 4.2.1, the sustainable energy one. You have an LLC that files for bankruptcy relief under Chapter 11. A trustee is appointed who sues Midwest LLC for having received the preference. Roughly $900,000 in payments that the defendant had made to the, I'm sorry, the debtor had made to the defendant during the 90 days before the bankruptcy case. And what do we think about?
So on one hand,
plain vanilla one.
This is fairly straightforward if we were to test out our shrub. The first question is this a state law claim that could be adjudicated outside bankruptcy? Well, 547 is a bankruptcy, derived cause of action. So then you would go to no, and if it's otherwise core, it remains at the bankruptcy court. So on that line, it's pretty much you're done at step two.
And do we think that you know what if the defendant had not filed a proof of claim?
So if the defendant had not filed a proof of claim, then I mean you could get into whether it mattered that the inbound outbound consent question or augmenting the bankruptcy estate. Isn't that what we were?
Well, at that point, right? It's you know the preference action exists only to augment the estate. It's resolving the preference is not necessary to resolving a proof of claim because there is no proof of claim asserted by the creditor. And yet nobody would really think that bankruptcy courts shouldn't be addressing preferences. It seems to me that most people would think that that's part of what bankruptcy judges do every day.
Right.
So, you know, I think preferences are safe, but I don't think we're entirely sure. Want to do Peterson?
Yeah, so this one is basically the trustee is filing a 548 action against creditors who had filed a proof of claim. And the first question is this a state law claim? Well, again, you know, although there is a state court analog, 548 is a federal bankruptcy court-derived action. So you could stop at step two as well, but... do we want to maybe look at the variation, which is on the next page, or do you want to say other things about this one?
Well, I mean, the thing that's so interesting about the fraudulent transfer problem is, as you know, there are lots of really large litigations going on around the country stemming from failed LBOs or other, you know, problematic transactions, right? So, you know, in REFCO and I think MF Global, they're both lots of fraudulent transfer causes of action. The Tribune has, you know, cases resulted in essentially a whole reverse class of fraudulent transfer defendants, all the shareholders who sold into the tender offer, Sam Zell's tender offer. And, you know, this creates really significant problems for both the courts and the lawyers because they, you know, they don't know for sure if they're supposed to be in the bankruptcy court or not.
This is a lot like Grand Financiera, except for in this hypothetical, a proof of claim had been filed.
Right.
So sorry, but we do have to wrap it up.
You do have to wrap
right.
it up.
Yep. I'm sure if you have questions about a particular nuance of this, that they'll be glad to stay and respond. Again, come back. Sorry for the technical difficulties and if that was distracting anybody here. Make sure you sign your CLE. Come back in June for Frank DeCastri. In July, student loans. In August, a tax issue. Thanks again to Jeff Woodson and Tommy Carlson.
Thank you.